They abandoned their belief in the supernatural. Now you are asking me to sabotage that achievement, to send them back into the dark ages of superstition and ignorance and fear? No!
And hello everyone, welcome to the new Forma Tool Show. I wish I could say a date and a time, but as we're recording this, we're time travelers for this. Please welcome to the new format, the new looking tool, and joining me tonight, the regulars, can we welcome Kitch? How are you doing?
I'm fantastic. How's everybody?
I think they're doing fine. It's a bit weird to try and ask people how they're, because we're so used to a chat room. We don't have it this time. It'll take a while for us to get used to. And welcoming Marty, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm okay.
Yep, and also joining us along for the pilot episode, Pumpkin, what's up?
My alcohol blood content.
It'll only get worse with this first section that we're doing. So I think very, very briefly we'll go over like what this new format's all about. As we say, all these sections are being pre-recorded like roughly a week in advance. So what you're going to get from now on is this opening introduction section. We're going to take a look at some news stories of interest and give our own kind of totally unbiased opinions on them. And later on, we will have our interview coming up. And this week's interview, I grabbed a hold of Spencer from Scottish Secular Society to talk about the new petition to ban creationism in Scottish schools. And later on, Big Lundy is starting his new feature, The Introduction to Philosophy. And also, we haven't named this section. This is a challenge for you listeners. If you can name the section where we let one of the listeners come in and they get their soapbox moment to promote themselves on the show, they get a 5-minute section. So I don't know, team, do you have any ideas for that, a name for that section yet?
Bastard on a box.
Okay. If you can beat that one. But first off, this question will be answered at the end of this show this week. And it's a question for everyone here. And it is, what connects the following? Whitney Houston, Colonel Gaddafi, Osama bin Laden, Robin Williams. Yeah, we'll just go with those. So Robin Williams, Whitney Houston, Gaddafi, and bin Laden. And not the obvious thing that they're all dead, but what connects them?
My recent trip to America?
No, it ties in very nicely into the skepticism, but I'll reveal it at the end of the show. So basically, keep your guesses coming in while you're listening to this. Marty, do you have any idea what the connection is there?
No, can't say I do.
And Pumpkin, you're going to come up with something ridiculous anyway, aren't you?
That time I took too much acid.
All right. No.
So, yes.
It was like they were there in the room.
So, shall we get into the news, everybody?
Sure.
Okay. Yes. Everyone's raring to go with the news section. So, first up, I've got a feeling this is going to record quite a lot, and it's related to Natural News and Mike Adams. I think he's going to be a rich social material. As we all know, the Ebola virus is very big news at the moment, and just to tie in nicely, Kitch, you're doing a section later on where you're going to actually give us all the scientific details about Ebola, aren't you?
Yeah, pretty much. I still have yet to record it, so...
Yeah. But it will come up later on in this show. So just very quickly, I'm going to run down. It's actually quite interesting because Natural News managed to have a blog post about Ebola that was so bad that even Natural News had to pull it at the end. And basically, what they came up with was they advertised a cure for Ebola. And so I'll just read quickly because it got pulled down, but there's quotes of it if you look online. I'll provide a link in the description. And basically, the guy who wrote this is apparently a Norwegian physicist. So everyone pile in with your jokes towards Mortimer just now for that. And it was quoted as saying, with dangerous large-scale epidemics, such as Ebola could turn out to be, the medical establishment is more than often not caught unprepared, as vaccines and or successful treatment take time to develop, and the logistics involved in distribution can be insurmountable. Therefore, you may be left to your own devices, in which case self-treatment, in particular homeopathy, will be your only hope of survival.
Oh,
Now, there's two ways you can take that. Does he mean homeopathy, as in take a drop of this, or hold your head under the water until you stop being alive?
So I don't know, Marty, what do you have to say to that so far?
Water doesn't treat Ebola very effectively, no.
No. But I know Kitch has read this, but he was very generous, and he actually told us how we can all go about curing Ebola. So,
this is going to be fun.
What you need, number one, a face mask and gloves. Number two, two bottles, 50 mil up to 500 mil, glass or plastic bottles with caps. Number three, clean water. It can be mineral or tap water. Number four.
But not fizzy.
Number four. This is a good one. If any of you out there, well, we're not going to be held responsible if you're dumb enough to try this, but let us know how you can achieve this. Number four. An Ebola sample, some spit, or other disease products such as blood from a person infected with Ebola or who is suspected to be sick with it. Any small quantity will do, even a pinhead.
So what you have to do is find someone with Ebola, stab them in the back, take the blood, and then use it for your medicine. That's the way to do it, because that won't at all infect
yes.
you.
No, there's still two more things you're going to need. Number four, an alcoholic liquid, such as whiskey, brandy, or rum. And number six, half an hour of your time.
Oh, man, I want half an hour I just can't afford.
I have 29 minutes. Will that suffice?
So, Kitch, I think I'll ask you very quickly, why is it so stupid to go out and just get an Ebola sample of someone infected?
Do you really need the biologist to explain this for you?
Well,
I'm pretty sure I covered that with my redundant statement.
I'm pretty certain I think everyone with a working functional brain can actually figure out why it's a bad idea to go to an infected person with Ebola and then just put it into your drink.
Yeah.
Seriously, this is like... I think that... Are you sure the title of this article is not How to Kill Yourself?
Or How to Assist the Spread of Ebola, even. Yeah, because I...
Hmm. Top ways
so I remember
to die.
I asked you this the other day, and that was like, even in your lab, you're not allowed to keep Ebola samples on hand like that.
No, we're not allowed to keep anything that could anyway possibly pathogenic. So getting a class 4 organism, that's just a bad, bad, bad idea.
I hope so.
Right.
Why does that not surprise me?
Shit, the device has been discovered. Deploy!
Okay, do you want to know how we can go about making this remedy?
Yes. Do we have to?
Procedure. Number one, fill the bottle with water, leaving 20% space at the top. Number two, put your Ebola sample in the water with a bottle. Number three, close the top of the bottle with a cap. Number four, hold the bottle and strike it hard against a solid surface, such as a large book, 40 times. Very specific there.
Didn't he say that you could use a glass bottle?
Yes.
I can see that becoming a problem as well.
Number five, pour out the contents of the water bottle. It doesn't say where or how. Number six, refill the bottle with water. The fluid remaining on the inside of the surface will serve as the next Ebola sample. Number seven, repeat steps 3 to 6 a total of 30 times. Yeah, see, just total silence there.
I'm sorry, I was too busy smashing my face against the fucking wall from the sheer stupidity.
Do we even need to explain how stupid that procedure is?
Yeah, I mean, he just said pour Ebola into the water supply.
Yeah. But there's one word of precaution he gives you. This is the safety. Avoid touching a pill with your fingers, as your energy field can neutralize the information carried.
What?
What the fuck?
Yeah,
that's the dangerous part of this whole procedure. Not the handling of the class 4 pathogen.
Oh, damn it.
Fucking Norwegians.
Norwegian telephone system curses us again. Yep.
It's push to talk, you dumb Viking bastard.
Yes, as I said, after you've gone out, you've stabbed someone with Ebola, you've just got to avoid touching it because you get your energy fields.
Yeah, because, you know, you won't be infected. In fact, even if you do that 30 times, there's still a chance you could be infected.
Yeah, like I said, you're probably going to cover how you can actually get Ebola. And for everyone, just keep on listening till you hear Kirch's section on why, on the ways you have to actually get a sample of Ebola, is you would literally have to stab someone or have sex with them or something like that.
Yeah, it's exchanged to bodily fluids. So if you come in contact with the bodily fluids of an affected person, you will become infected.
Yeah. Okay, so...
Yeah. To summarize.
And Kitch, you've got the next news story.
Yes, this story actually comes from Nature. It was 2 weeks old, but I still want to bring it up because it is quite interesting and kind of alarming. It's about 2 incidents that actually happened in a CDC lab back in March and June. In the first incident, a sample of a low-virulence flu virus was transferred to another lab, but it was accidentally contaminated with H5N1, which is an avian flu strain. It was sent to pretty much another lab that was not able to handle it, to contain it and store it. So that was kind of concerning because it could have easily got out. Well, so, easily might be a bit of a stretch, but you know, it's still risky.
Yeah. So what exactly was the cause of the foul up here? Has it been determined?
Not that I could see. It was just breaking a protocol.
Yeah.
The safety procedures just weren't followed.
So what you're saying is science nearly killed us all again, you bastards.
I don't think it was science. I think it was someone who screwed up.
Yeah, I think it was just like a faulty process, which could happen in any industry. It's not unique to science.
But that way I can't feel all high and mighty about my positions.
Mm-hmm. But you know, like we said, like people like Mike Adams, they jump on these things, but that happens in every single industry. There's foul-ups, so...
Yeah, and just for, you know, in case people run into people who do jump on something like this, the problem isn't science. The problem is the people using science.
Yeah.
You know, they're humans. Humans make mistakes. It happens.
And so do you have anything further on that story, Kitch?
Yes, there was a second incident, and it involves the transfer of inadequately inactivated anthrax, so the bacteria just weren't killed properly. It was from a BSL level 3 lab to a lower safety level, so probably 2 or 1, it doesn't say. Basically, it just wasn't able to handle such a... If you're working with a high-level bacteria, they usually kill it or remove some of the harmful genes. They work with it in such a way so it's not going to be an issue.
Yeah.
And so that's why you can still study it.
Okay.
But there's not a risk to yourself or the general public around you. But in this case, it wasn't properly inactivated. Someone messed up in the procedure and they got potentially something with live anthrax.
Yeah. And the important thing to point out is these foul-ups have actually been publicized. You know,
yes, there is no cover-up. That's right.
Like I said, people always claim, oh, what are they hiding? And, oh, this happened. Well, it's available in the journals and all that. But as we know, people would read these articles. I'm pretty sure if this actually got into the papers, they would cover it in a totally different manner.
Oh, like a certain English journal?
Yes.
Possibly daily released and in the something to do with the mail.
Rhymes with fail. Appropriately enough.
Yeah.
But anyway, this will see you into like the whole cover-up thing. It's another story. It's a few weeks old, and Marty actually brought this up before we started recording today. And this was a very notorious article that our good friend Mike Adams wrote.
Oh, yeah.
We don't really want to, because reading his stuff is a glimpse into insanity, basically, what that guy writes. I have no qualms. I'm usually very reluctant to comment, but I think Mike Adams is genuinely crazy. Now, if you ever go to Mike Adams's blog, there's something, no matter what story it is, he can link it to Monsanto and vaccines and 9/11. And this story was, he was just, I think Monsanto celebrated some anniversary recently, Kirch, or something, did they? There was some reason anyway he was speaking about Monsanto. And he basically said, the Nazis did these experiments, Monsanto's done experiments, therefore Monsanto are as bad as the Nazis.
That, wait, what?
That was seems his legit reasoning. But that's yeah, not the crazy part. That's
exactly.
The crazy part was later on when he also went, but the people of Germany tried to assassinate Hitler and therefore we should do the same to scientists.
That is concerning.
Yes. And although he's kind of later back, oh, I never said murder scientists, it's pretty difficult to not see that's what he was heavily implying.
Actually, that is what he was saying. He just took down the article after someone complained to the feds about it.
And the feds kind of, I think they had a friendly phone call with him.
Yeah, something yeah, like that.
But yeah, that's like what we say about people spreading bad information. I mean, the most concerning thing for me is I see people sharing natural news articles on my social media. And it's actually worrying that people are taking on what these people say.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out why it is that Mike Adams isn't in a straitjacket in a padded room, steadily being fed happy pills.
Yeah. Well, what he's doing is much worse. He's making rap music a lot, so.
Okay. I can take the genocide of science. I can take murdering scientists. I can take links to Nazism. But rap music? No, that's where I draw the fucking line.
Especially Mike Adams's rap music. It's a joy to behold, basically. It's kind of in its sheer just nuttiness and awfulness. It's he basically, I think it's been established, he downloads, you know, like you get these loops online. He gets these R&B loops. He just stretches it out for 4 minutes and then he just starts rapping about the New World Order over it.
My God, that is...
I don't want to live on this planet anymore.
This is indeed a disturbing universe.
And as we said, like Monsanto, they've done some questionable things, but Monsanto do not represent all of genetic modification, all of GMO and that, do they, Kirch?
Of course not. But like saying McDonald's represents all of the fast food industry or... I've just been dumbfounded by the stupidity of what we just heard. I'm just trying to get my brain to kick into gear. It's like saying...
Or like saying like Ford made some unsafe cars, therefore all cars are dangerous.
Yeah, it's pretty much like that. Or it's saying Ford has made some crap cars, therefore combustion science is just not safe.
Yeah. That's probably, that's a better one. And... also, just a bit, and this will probably be our last bit on Mike Adams. Yeah, he did put up a blog post about Robin Williams, and he did go on about depression. And yes, he did find a way to link Robin Williams' suicide to 9/11.
What?
How?
I'm not even going to link to that because it's just, yeah. He does an obituary to Robin Williams, and you know, he was saying comedians are the real people. We need to defend the truth and all this. When so many people don't see the truth of 9/11 and all this shit. So, yeah, I said, go read Natural News, people, you know, just for...
If you want to laugh.
Yeah, if you just want the sheer experience of it. And I think we'll now finish off with the section with Marty's news story.
Yeah, I actually have some... Well, I think it's good news anyway, as far as I can tell. This was posted on... This Week in Pseudoscience.
Okay.
They usually have some interesting stuff about stupid people. And it turns out that in 2012, there was a class action lawsuit filed against Standard Homeopathic Corporation.
Right.
Or company or whatever for unfair and deceptive practices. And just a couple of days ago, it turns out that this has been certified by a judge.
Yeah, all right.
What's going on here, apparently, is that it's not even skeptics who are suing them for, you know, spreading bullshit. It's actually people who have bought homeopathic remedies and realized that they do nothing.
That's even better.
Yeah, exactly. That I think this is great. Like, people who have been stupid enough to actually buy this shit have realized that maybe the reason why it doesn't do anything is that, you know, it doesn't do anything. Yeah, but they were told it does something. Yeah, and they were told it was going to work, or at least that this will treat this symptom you have or something like that. And of course it didn't. And the problem with homeopathy and all alternative medicine really is that you can't, I mean, they're not breaking any laws per se, because they're not saying it's medicine. This term alternative medicine is sort of a, it's a safe way to peddle snake oil, essentially. Yeah.
Like, if you actually look on a lot of alternative medicine, the packets they come on, they it actually does say, like, you know, if symptoms persist, please go and see a doctor. Yeah. So they kind of like to, they basically cover their bases a lot of the time.
Yeah, because they could actually be facing felony charges if they don't do that. But what's happened now is that someone has actually raised a civil claim, as I understand it, against a homeopathic company. And yeah, I just think it's great that this is happening.
Marty, in Sweden, can you get homeopathic remedies on the health service there?
Not that I know of. I haven't actually checked.
Yeah, because...
But I'm pretty sure you have to go to, like...
an actual AltMed shop.
Yeah.
Okay, because in the UK, on our National Health Service, homeopathic remedies are available, and there's homeopathic clinics. Yeah. There's been millions spent on setting up the clinics.
Yeah.
Kitch, just, I think we'll get your last thoughts on that news item.
It sounds brilliant. It's got this, I hope they win.
Yeah.
Take the homeopathy down a bit, down a few notches, hopefully several million notches.
Yeah, and if this works, that sets a precedent as well. I mean, now, basically, if they win, the door is open to actually file charges against, like, psychics, for example.
Yeah.
They said they were going to do something. They didn't do it.
But surely in the homeopathic world, the more you keep suing them and the more they're losing, the actual stronger homeopathy is going to get.
Yeah.
That's how a homeopathic lawsuit would work, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or a homeopathic bank account. The more money you and keep, if you keep just leaving more fractions of a penny, the richer you're actually getting.
Well, surely when it comes to the defense counsel for that, he's just going to have to water down the arguments so much that it overpowers the jury.
Yeah. Yeah, because that was a great thing. It's actually to bring you, Martin. I can't pronounce the guy's name, but was it the Swedish astronaut? Because he did that a few years ago when he overdosed on
homeopathic. Yeah.
Yep. What Marty just said. He actually overdosed on homeopathy. I think it was a few of the Swedish skeptics did that.
Yeah, it's been done all over the world. Yeah. James Randi does that all the time in talks he gives. Like, he starts out by taking 30 pills. Of course it does nothing.
I'm actually curious, is overdosing on homeopathic medicine the same thing as drowning?
I would assume so.
That's a question for the audience. Let us know. Give us feedback on that. What do you think? Anyway, we're coming to the end. Did you have any last things, Pumpkin, you want to get out?
Cardinal Sean Brady has offered the Pope his resignation.
Okay.
Because by Catholic law, whenever a cardinal hits 75, they're required to hand in the resignation. It's just up to the Pope whether or not to accept it or not. This is a good thing because the guy has been mired in abuse claims and cover-ups. So hopefully that fucking asswipe will be fired or, you know, resign.
Or just move to another parish.
Yep. I don't think there's much we can really add to the child abuse scandal in the church, is there?
Kick him in the bollocks.
Oh. Yeah, well, that's the Pumpkin solution to everything, isn't it?
Pretty much.
That and set fire to things.
All right, I think we can close out this section of the show now, can't we? That's our first attempt at the new format and the new news section. How was it for you guys?
It felt so good.
Well, after some editing, I'm sure it'll work.
Yes. Like I say, I'm sure in the future there's going to be a nice blooper reel for everyone to listen into.
That'd be cool. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
You can just tell me. Anyway, what do we have coming up? Like I said, we've got an interview with Spencer Fields from the Scottish Secular Society. We have Big Lundy and his introduction to philosophy coming up. We've got the Kitch, who will be giving you the lowdown on Ebola and how not to treat it. We need to go there. And then in our new section, I think it's Mary Ziller. Yeah, that's who, I forgot his name. Mary Ziller, he's going to be actually doing a rebuttal to some flat earthers at the end of the show.
Oh, very interesting.
Well, it's something, now I'm just going to quickly say, a lot of people say, why rebut flat earthers and all that? But it's like I say with Cool Hard Logic, when he's rebutted geocentric, he explains a lot of good concepts in physics by doing that.
Yes.
It helps explain some concepts that people might not understand.
Absolutely. There's a lot of ways to use Pwnage in an educational way.
Yeah. And just one thing, if you listen to the end for the, there's going to be a little section of us closing. This is just to let you all know, we are launching our Patreon alongside this wonderful new show. If you want to donate to support us, like I said, we are not going to make money from this show. That's the one thing we've always stuck by. All the money's going to do is it's going to pay for our editor and it's going to pay for us to have a professional file hosted service, but we'll explain it all later on. So I say, hope you enjoyed all this, and I don't know what's coming up next. It's going to be edited together, but upcoming is the next segment. So please enjoy.
Hello all, I've got a cheery subject to talk about on my first segment on the new tool podcast format, Ebola. Well, first off, I'm getting my information from the CDC and the World Health Organization. If you're interested or concerned about the most recent outbreak, I recommend those websites. And not natural news. Just don't, okay? Please, you'll thank me. There have been several outbreaks of Ebola in the past. The biggest one, prior to the most recent outbreak in Guinea, Liberia, Nigeria and Sierra Leone, was in Uganda in 2000 with 425 cases and 224 deaths. Now compare that to the most recent outbreak where there are so far 1,310 cases with 1,145 deaths at the time of this recording. The fatality rate is scaringly high, with an untreated fatality rate of 90%. However, with medical intervention, that rate does drop to around 60%, still concerningly high. Outbreaks begin by the transmission of the virus from an animal to human. Although the natural reservoir is not known, it is thought that fruit bats are the natural host. We humans are just an accidental host. So, yay! Aren't we the lucky ones? Further, Ebola has been documented to infect chimps and gorillas. Now, person-to-person transmission occurs when a person is exposed to the bodily fluids from an infected individual. Considering that late symptoms are bleeding and vomiting blood, it means that the medical personnel must be very cautious when working with Ebola patients. And they have been infected before. Further, considering that a dead person can still have a high viral load, it puts the people who prepare the body for burial at risk of infection. Also, mistrust and lack of understanding about Ebola in some infected communities can also aid in its spread. When a person is infected with Ebola, it first attacks the immune system, which causes the release of immune messengers called cytokines. These cause the blood vessels to become more leaky, for want of a better term, which allows Ebola to affect the inner layer of the blood vessel, known as the endothelium, more effectively. During this infection process, a protein of the Ebola shell called GP can then cause the endothelial cells to detach, which further increases fluid loss. Also, during the course of the infection, the virus also does something pretty sneaky. It stops the endothelial cell from making interferon, which is a warning signal to nearby cells to tell them that there's something nasty and to get ready because things are about to go crazy. Death occurs from blood loss. Now, there is no cure or vaccine available for Ebola currently. Ebola patients are put on rehydration therapy with the aim of replacing fluids faster than they are lost. Now, the WHO have approved experimental drugs to be used in the most recent outbreak. I have my own issues with this, as there's a chance that this drug may worsen the situation and further increase the mistrust there is in some of the infected communities. But what do you guys think? Let us know. Kitch signing off. And stay tuned for the next segment. It'll be fantastic.
And hello everyone, welcome to the new format, Tony Wologic. You're listening to the pilot episode, and here, as promised, I have a familiar face, or familiar sounding voice, seen as we're audio only now, welcoming back Scottish Secular Society Chairman Spencer Fields.
Hello, thanks for having me on the show again, Cap.
And I got your name correct the first time for once as well.
No, you didn't. You got it wrong again.
Oh, Jesus.
Right, it's Files. Forget about the B.
Yeah. I don't know where that's coming from. Anyway, we've got you along here to talk, you know, if you are interested more in what Spencer's had to say, you can go back in the archives. You were on the charity show with us and you did an interview a few weeks before that. We're here to talk a little bit more in depth on something you touched on in the last few appearances, and that is the most recent petition. So can you give us a little background on what the petition actually is?
Yeah, in Scotland, we're in a really bizarre situation. Within all our local health authorities, well, sorry, local education authorities, we have three, sometimes four, or even five unelected religious officials who are allowed to participate in educational content and direction of each school. But what we've had some issues in the past with creationism, and we've had some issues with opt-in and opt-out of religious observance. We have many parents come to us on a periodic basis, basically, you know, frustrated that their children have to mandatorily participate in false praying religious observance. But some of the religionists out there like to take that a little bit further. I mean, a quarter of chaplains that actually work with schools believe in creationism. So we had a major scandal in Kirkland Primary School last year. We found that there were some members of a local sect had actually infiltrated the school for 8 years. But the line was actually crossed when they handed out creationism material. That was the final straw for a lot of parents, and that actually made the national press. Yeah, and there was a major investigation that led up to that. And then there was also the Centre for Intelligent Design opened up in Glasgow in 2010, and Scottish Schools, Secondary Schools Teachers Association and the Education Institute of Scotland went to the government at that time to ask for explicit guidance on how they dealt with creationism when it arose in the classrooms, especially in science class. But unfortunately, none was forthcoming. And since then, we have repeated reports from pupils, from students, from parents and teachers, that this problem still exists. And especially at a real topical time when England and Wales have now acted upon issues that have prevailed from the sort of Trojan horse incident in England, they're starting to take actions to make sure that this gets knocked in the head before it can manifest, whereas Scotland, unfortunately, is still dragging the heat somewhat. So we basically petitioned the Scottish Parliament to disrupt the education sector to issue guidance to publicly funded schools and colleges to prevent the teaching and creation of related doctrine, basically as a viable alternative to these practices. I mean, this doesn't include discussion of things. This doesn't stop creation from being discussed in religious and moral education classes, by all means, but it should never slip out with that classroom door. So we're seeking for clarification, basically, and we've offered some provisional draft language that we hope will take the case.
So it seems like the problem as it is it's kind of quite nebulous language that's in the current legislation.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, Carl. There actually is no current guidance. This is the problem. If you look at the 1980 Education Scotland Act, there is a legal obligation that religion must be taught in the school. There's also a legal obligation to hold religious observance. So by default, that then leads to the invitation of local chaplaincies working hand in hand with the school committee sitting on the school board dictating what that policy may look like. It even goes far as dictating what the sexual education policy may look like within the schools. Bearing in mind, this is men who have made a commitment to celibacy to God. So how on earth would they be the best position to talk about sexual education? But in the context of creationism and things that shouldn't be discussed, there is no guidance. It literally says it's left to the discretion of teachers or the head teachers, which leaves this massive void and gap of ambiguity. And it creates such a dynamic that there is nothing formal that a teacher can actually fall back on. So seeing the instance, a new qualified teacher was teaching primary course, and there's an incident that we had fed back to us about a month ago, I mentioned previously on the show, with one primary school in Fife, where so the whole assembly, the local chaplain had the children all shouting back to him, "Who made us, kids?" The kids would shout back, "God made us." "Who made us? God made us." And make them shout this five or six times to constantly repeat God, the term "God made us." Now, if you're a new teacher or a teacher of any length of time in that school, and you think, right, now that contradicts our science teaching that goes against evolutionary teaching, and you want to take that up as an issue, there actually isn't a formal vehicle that you can reference. There is no formal guideline that you can actually quote from. And there is no process other than a quiet word in the head's ear. Now, the head more than likely will have a long relationship with the local chaplaincy, and they'll be fairly embedded, and they won't want to knock the apple cart. And this is what the government doesn't see, because there isn't any methodology behind this investigation. And there's just nowhere for teachers to go. And parents, when children return home with, say, colouring in of the crucifixion or colouring in of books with people using dinosaurs as transportation vehicles, then there's nowhere for anyone to go, because there are no guidelines in place. And it's really unfortunate. So what this petition set out to do is to make sure that the government actually do address this. And there's a whole host of ways in which they can do it. You just want to be capitalist to actually get them to.
Like, I had a few experiences in school myself. Like, I'm 35 now, so this would be back in the early 90s. And the first one I had was, you know, secondary one and two, you get your basic science education. And I remember specifically our teacher just said she wouldn't discuss origins because it's too controversial.
Yeah.
And then later on, like, in a more advanced science with a different teacher, they just out and out said it was creation. And, like, there's a whole lot of other stuff. I mean, no, this may be unique to, you know, where I'm from, and, you know, the listeners will probably recognize my accent and that. But I know that the other high school in Lewis, they actually had Ken Ham come in for a science class and give them a whole science class once. Of course, there's no way we can actually go back and prove that this happened, but, you know, it is a thing. We do know it happened, but proving it would be... Like, from what you're saying, that could happen again quite easily. You could have someone like your Ken Ham come in and give us a science class.
Yeah.
And there'd be no fallback.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, we estimate that there's 600 chaplains out there that currently sit on or have some kind of interaction with schools in Scotland that believe in creationism. So, I mean, we've got many of them are named. We did propose these names on our petition to the Scottish Government, but they thought that was slightly contentious and wanted to remove them. But this was based on evidence that was presented to us by concerned parents and also on the Freedom of Information request. The problem is, the present situation is actually placing unreasonable responsibility on teachers. It's fairly unaided monitoring as well. I mean, even the materials from CRACE are creating test boxes. And the activities of visitors and individuals who go into the school, they're not formal part of the teaching staff, and that's another problem. You know, they're not vetted or mandated, they just happen to be pals with the local school, and nothing more than that.
Like, you know, all the background checks that most people have to go through to work with children, do they have to go through that as well?
No, they're exempt from that. I think they were exempt up until 2010, and I believe there is something in place now, but I don't think it's the same as what teachers or nurses have to go through.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the same level of investigation. What's the terminology for that again? It doesn't apply to them because obviously they're responsible for nothing but canon law. So the law of the land tends to be a completely different thing, as we've found out with some of the wider issues with Christianity and children, let's just say. So, we just feel quite sad that this is even necessary in 2014, that, you know, we have to be approaching the government to act on this. The arrangements at the moment are just unacceptable, and it leads to scandalous situations. You know, we just can't have. There's an organisation as well called People with a Mission Ministries who have a bus.
Yes.
Yeah, you're familiar with them.
Yep.
I may have spoken with them before as well, but on their bus and on their website for sale, they have openly creationist material. Now, they are allowed to literally park the bus inside school playgrounds. So the school kids on a primary by primary and by class by class sort of a rotation go into this bus and are taught everything that these biblical literalists want to tell the children. And it's a free reign, you know. It's not mentored, it's not managed. And I'm sorry, but I just find that that's really unacceptable, actually. When we've got so many younger creationists visiting schools and offering this propaganda, is that utterly absurd?
So would you think that maybe Scotland's lost out on some science talent because of this?
No, I think what's brilliant about Scotland at the moment, and we've again highlighted this to the government, is, you know, our life sciences industry is absolutely flourishing at the moment. You know, if you go down the just outside Edinburgh or Dundee, for instance, you know, some of the work that's been done. And I work with the NHS as a service provider, but I work with some fairly eminent people and I speak regularly to the chief scientific officer of the Scottish Executive. And so, yeah, I mean, if we can focus our future, our children have to basically remain free to investigate, you know, to swim in the realms of science, because anything that contradicts or distorts the teaching of physics, chemistry, biology, or evolution for me is a massive stumbling block. To place any element of doubt where free thought is concerned is dangerous. And it should always be kept well within context of religious education and nothing more. So, yeah, so it will have a way to deal with it whilst children are at a really young age.
Yeah, because I do, like, just from my observations going to school, I do think, even just in my years at school, that we did lose some potential science talent there because, you know, the sciences weren't taught that enthusiastically. I mean, the Isle of Lewis has a great history of engineers and things like that. Like I say, I work in the engineering field, but I do feel kind of because of the church influence in the formative years, there probably was some great talent that has slipped through the net because of that.
And that's a real shame, you know. And we've given the government, I mean, my predecessor, Caroline Lynch, she also wrote in on the back of the curriculum scandal to ask what the government were going to do about it. And again, she was met with political inertia. There's just a massive unwillingness to address anything when it comes to religion, when it comes to education in this country, because the two of them are so entwined. You know, we really need to disentangle the sort of cultural attitude that they have. I mean, creationism and intelligent design, they're anti-scientific views, and they're deeply divisive. They're confusing and in an educational context, but it defeats the hard work of our teachers, and it defeats other areas of the curriculum as well. in these topics, it's just got no place in Scottish primary or secondary science education. And both that, it's got no place whatsoever in any way on their education. And it should always stay within the realms of a religious moral education class. I mean, if left unchecked, there's all sorts of potential and effect. What you quite rightly point out is a precious resource of our own, and that's our children. And the replacements that you touched on as well, and the consequences of it as well, it just can't be an issue in Scotland. And the confidence in it can easily be shattered when these things arise. And now's the time, basically, for the government to take some positive and assertive action. We've got to safeguard the education of our kids. I mean, and that's what we ask. That's what we want them to declare. We're actually not asking for anything major. We really just want the government to acknowledge that they're willing to, you know, even if they look at it from an interventional perspective, and they don't buy into the evidence and the weight of evidence that we're going to present to them in the petition, then at least if they can address it now, as England and Wales have done, you know, then they put blocks on it. They put a full stop on it right there and then.
Yep.
And it doesn't go any further. And you know, it protects religion. It can allow that discussion to continue to flourish within the context of a religious discussion, and it can allow science to flourish. And that's ultimately what we want. And you know, this has been backed up. The petition itself has now grown to 551 signatures. Now, in the grand scale of things, you might think, for a petition, is that good, is that bad or not? I mean, it's the second highest petition that's currently on the table with the Public Petitions Committee at the moment. But it's when you look at the content of the signatories, we have 3 Nobel Prize winners have now signed the petition.
Yep.
I mean, 3. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I think that is fantastic. Now, that is also testimony to the fact that they also think there's an issue. And within the rest of the 500, there's many teachers, so I've recognised a few names, there's medics, there's the head of the National Secular Society, there's the head of the Humanist Society, Peter Thatchell has also put his name to it as well, you know, we've spoken to some other political big hitters who haven't signed it for political reasons, but actually have anecdotally expressed support for the petition, you know, I mean, the 3 Nobel Prize winners, so John Sulston from the Manchester University of Science, Ethics and Innovation, we have Sir Harold Croteau and Sir Richard Roberts. He's the 3rd Nobel Prize winner for signing the petition. So we really hope that these are the kind of names that will make the Public Petitions Committee set up and take note, and then act, hopefully, and you know, move this the petition forward to see if they're actually write out and see if they're actually ever first risk. Because I'm pretty confident if they write to the Education Institute of Scotland or Secondary School Teachers Association, they most certainly will jump on this. And they most certainly will ask for more explicit guidance.
There's one thing that I've seen come up quite a lot, and it's the attitude, like, why are you bothering with this with obviously the 18th of September coming up? You know, could you not just wait till that's over? I mean,
we've asked ourselves that question many times, because everyone's distracted with the 18th of... But one of the things that with secularism, Cal, is you can't put a time limit on it. You know, we can't... If we feel that our sort of compulsion to act on something, we really have to do it right now, you know. And we're aware, obviously, the distraction of independence hasn't been helpful to the cause, let's just say, because everyone's distracted at the moment. However, the Scottish Secular Society came out openly in support, as you probably are aware of, of independence for Scotland. So, you know, if we arrive both these votes in parallel at the same time, you never know who picks up on these things, and you never know where you can garner the support from. I mean, I think, you know, with hindsight, we should have probably left it till after the independence vote. But, you know, it's up and running now. We've engaged with lots of people. We've spoke over the phone to lots of people. We've emailed. We have the petition. We have had a lot of exposure. We've had investigation from several newspapers. Unfortunately, none of them have run with it yet. However, I'm hoping the Herald are now going to run with it, now that they're aware we have a 3rd Nobel Prize signature as well. So they called the other day asking for more information on it. So fingers crossed on that. That'll give it a massive rebuff.
Has there been any pushback from the Scottish creationists at all? Like any of the...
Nothing.
Nothing?
We've heard nothing. And no, Professor Bateman, who put the core of the text together for the petition, and it is essentially his petition. I just submitted it. He's hoping that this will actually bring him out a little bit, you know, and get him to come out into the public realm. Because one of the... Again, it goes back, it's very difficult get nuts. Until these things until they come to us, we have no idea what is happening where. We don't know what their agenda looks like at the moment. But it's pretty obvious by their default setting that they want to get to kids, and they want to talk about the fact that Earth is 6,000 years old. They want to talk about flood theory. You know, they want to implement their religious perspective of the world and their worldview. So we need to find out and where are they doing this, and who are they doing it with, and frequently are they doing it. And so, you know, there's no good or bad time to start looking for these things and that fund. And as long as we can get the government to you know, draw some attention to it, then, you know, I mean, it could actually be a welcome distraction for the Petitions Committee. I believe they sit next on the 30th of September, and I'm pretty sure whatever the outcome, they'll be quite happy to get back to normal parliamentary affairs.
Yeah. So what is, kind of, say the petition goes through, what is the next step after that for those who are unfamiliar with the system of petitioning?
Well, the next step is it gets presented to the Public Petitions Committee, who would look at the evidence that we put forward and consider whether or not this is big enough to move to the next step, which would be the Education and Culture Committee. And what the Education and Culture Committee will then do, they will, between them, they'll do a call for evidence, basically. They'll put forward what we propose to various bodies. This will include all the different religious bodies. This may include humanists. This may include any other society, the educational institutes and bodies, the union bodies, parent-teacher councils, etc. And what they'll then do, once they'll have a deadline on amassing that body of evidence, and then we will possibly be asked, hopefully be asked to go in and then present our case directly to the Education and Culture Committee, or in fact prior to that, the Actual Petition Committee. But hopefully if we can get to the stage where we can get in front of the Education and Culture Committee, they'll be the ones who actually may hopefully decide to look at this, develop some guidelines, and make sure that they get published and that they're frequently audited, hopefully audited and implemented by school inspectors as well. So at least then, if they're aware of it, then
Yeah. So what kind of time scale would you look like, just if it does all go well, that it would be implemented?
I'm not entirely sure how long the process is between the initial reading of the petition and the next stage for that, the Education and Culture Committee. But I would be hoping that sort of a quarter one of next year that we could be done and dusted with it.
Okay.
I mean, depending on the outcome, it's not something that we're going to give up on. I mean, it's like opting in and opting out petition that we proposed to the government. You know, although it didn't go as far as we wanted it to, we did decide to take some action after investigating, you know, where the access to information lay within school. The only way they can actually do that in any sense is to pass ownership of that investigation onto the school inspectors.
Just to bring up, obviously, the 18th of September, I take it, no, we'll just go with the hypothetical that it is a successful yes vote. I'm guessing this will be one of the platforms the society will be pushing for, yeah, like, in the new constitution.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, Elliot Bulmer, who authored the book, A Model Constitution for an Independent Scotland, actually put out our position statement as far as independence and secularism is concerned. I mean, the most obvious thing here, Cal, is if we go independent, is we instantly get rid of hereditary peerage and we instantly get rid of 26 unelected bishops from the House of Lords. That's the biggie for us as far as the secular society is concerned. And what we can then do by, you know, that's something that can no longer influence Scottish policy, and that allows us to streamline and then, you know, really sort of rein in our focus as to, you know, how we work our own constitution and how we push that constitution into a working strategy, wherever religious privilege or wherever there's unfair representation or influence by religion in Scottish society. It just makes things less ambiguous for us, you know. But yeah, I mean, we really have our fingers crossed for the independence vote to go for yes, because having a second chamber of unelected bishops dictating or vetoing policy that affects Scottish people is preposterous.
And are you quite hopeful of, well, again, if the vote goes for a yes, that you'll at least get listened to by the politicians? Because I know just from what I see on the message boards and our private chats that it is quite difficult getting their attention for the secular society.
It is, but you know, there's ways that we've started to approach that. And when I inherited this tenure as chair of the Scottish Cycle Society, I wanted to make sure that we got our outreach methods sorted, that we actually had a strategy for it. So we've identified a whole list of who we believe are the most likely movers and shakers within the political sphere, and indeed with the religious commentators as well, to engage with them. I mean, for instance, we have Patrick Harvey coming to our November meet, and he's going to give us a better insight into the mechanisms of the political mind and how secularism sort of, and why certain politicians are reluctant to express their atheism or secular perspective. And we all know the kinds of votes at the end of the day. And obviously they want to reflect they want to represent their constituents. But what we need to do is get the right kind of politicians and the right kind of engagement. Now, you have grants going to the Interfaith Council, for instance. And although that's a faith council, I think it's absolutely essential that the nuns are represented at these meetings. If it becomes singular and faith-based only and it becomes a closed shop to everyone who are not of any kind of religion, then how on earth can they possibly make progress? If they're only looking to make progress between understanding of each religion, then that's fine. But if they want to make progress within a wider social context, they must engage with people who are of non-belief. We are now the majority in Scotland. You know, only 8% of the Scottish population are adherents to the Church of Scotland. 8%, that's 92% are not. Yet then, and if you look at the Muslim Council of Scotland, who sit at 1.4% of the population, they all have a hotline to our most senior politicians. You know, I mean, it's almost on a bi-monthly basis now. The Muslim Council of Scotland have photo opportunity because they have a hotline to the Kenny McCaskill, Nicola Sturgeon, and Malik Salmon of this world. And they hop, skip, and jump at the first beck and call. Yet, the nuns, the free thinkers, the skeptics, the humanists, the atheists, and the atheist secularists of this world, we have no representation whatsoever in these meetings. And I think it's essential that we address this. And I don't think, theoretically, what I would love if I had a utopian approach to this is that we created some formal coalition and we took this forward. I would really love to see all these bodies that are working in synergy to a large extent with a similar objective, looking for the same outcomes, to actually get their heads together and create some kind of secular coalition where we can have a strong arm and a strong Muslim demand that we have representation, demand that our politicians put into it. I mean, these councils are being funded. You know, they've been afforded grants to set themselves up, establish themselves, form manifestos, and then, you know, decide how their outreach policy is going to look. And this is all signed off by signatures of government. But at the same time, this is what, if you think about it as well, that's being imposed on the non-believers. It's basically, how can you best inform non-believers? You must be more tolerant of your belief. Yet there isn't another version of that where there's an atheist group telling the religious groups how you should be more tolerant of atheists. And you need to understand where we're coming from. If we're going to have mutual harmony, you have to understand our role and our position. But unfortunately, there only seems to be one voice, and there only seems to be one level of sponsorship, and that's unfortunately, at this moment, it's for religious. But I'm seeking to change that. And the only way that we can do that is I'm a big believer in face-to-face contact, is by actually turning up at these meetings and demanding representation, as well as emailing, phoning, and engaging them in the public and in the public sphere. That's really what we want to do. And we were invited recently to the European Human Rights Committee on their call for evidence on religion and belief. So Gary Otten and I, who's the founder of the Scottish Secular Society, attended that meeting. And again, it was all down to these equalities of how religion is dealt with in the workplace and the social sphere. But I said this to the guys at the meeting, the human rights guys, that this is all coming from one direction. You're only thinking of it through the lens of the religious. You're not thinking about this through secularists and non-believers. And it's the same old story. And until you do that, both camps will entrench themselves. You know, and there won't be a willingness to engage and understand that you're not even opening the doors for us. I mean, we looked at the registry form for those who've been in that meeting over a 2-year period. And we were the first non-religious body that entered that room. And there must have been 15 different religious bodies over a two-day period, given hour after hour to state their case as to what they want their religion to be in Scotland. And we were tagged on right at the end at 5 o'clock when they're busy looking at their watches hoping to catch that 25 past 5 train. So, you know, until we can remove that tokenistic perspective that they have on groups such as the Scottish Ethical Society, then, you know, we're not going to accelerate where we want to be with these groups. But I'm quite positive about it. You know, I'm personally hearing the right things now, that there is a willingness for them to engage with us, and that there is indeed a willingness for the government to actually get all bodies together as well. So hopefully next year, once the independence vote's kind of done and dusted a bit, we can get on with that.
Yeah. How much do you feel like, to think the best way to put this, like the psychostatic, in my view, I think we started too late and the religionists had already managed to poison the well against secularism. You know, they'd made it already a dirty word. So when the society came along, we were already fighting against that image. We didn't even get to start out with people saying, what's this? They just point, oh, you're the anti-religion folk.
Yeah. Oh, I've had that. I mean, I think I've been on four radio shows so far. And, you know, some of it's quite insulting, Cal. I mean, they've done it. They were very quick to define us because they're smart cookies, these religionists, you know, and they want to protect their privilege. They're not going to give it up easy. And they quite clearly see us as a threat because they don't have a counter-argument with secularists, because if you actually look at what secularism is, now, from country to country, it's defined really within the context of what the political spectrum looks like within that, you know, what is the political structure in that country. Like Egyptian secularism is completely different from Scottish secularism because the needs are different, obviously. But what they've done in the UK, they've been very quick to position us or frame us very much as being aggressive or militant or, you know, and we always ask the same question of, can you please define it to us, because we're baffled what you mean. All we use are words, sharp words. Clever people out there that can put up some fantastic arguments. If you look at how we deconstruct creationist arguments, they have nowhere to go with it. And it's a battle that we're going to have to constantly do. I think it was on Richard Holloway's show, when I was speaking to a chap from the Sky, David Klein, he's named me again. And we were talking about, I mean, this is a classic example, we're talking about opening up thought to the non-religious people. And he said, yeah, but if you do that, you'll just dilute it. Effectively saying that there wasn't enough philosophers or free thinkers or educated people in Scotland that could offer quite the same quality of educational content or substance as what he could, because he was religious. And this all comes back to how they define them, they define everyone that is not of them, everyone that is different. And they have a field day when it comes to secularists. I mean, over the last 12 months, when as soon as secularism was mentioned, the word militant always precedes it, always, without a shadow of it, or aggressive, assertive, and yet there's not one shred of evidence that says we have done anything that has overstepped the line. We've had nothing, we've asked for nothing but equality. That's all we ask, is that religion is treated equally as those who are of no religion. And they think us asking for that to be ironed out and unfolded, then, you know, they have a real problem. But you're right, Carl, you know, they've done a cracking job in making sure they've managed to frame us in that sense. But when you push them into a corner and ask them to define it, they've got nowhere to go with it. But unfortunately, they've allowed these platforms where they're allowed to say it, and it goes unquestioned. Commentators, reporters, interviewers will not say to them, well, give me an example of aggressive secularism. They just use it loosely, you know, and it seems to be accepted as well. So when you tell someone you're a secularist, yeah, they immediately think that, you know, you're out to get them. And that's not news.
It's quite strange because back home, I have been advised to keep it quiet. You know, back
really?
Yes. I've heard people say, for the sake of your family, you better keep that quiet. Don't say there's nothing, there's going to be no violence, but there'll be whispers and they could be shunning over this. I mean, it's quite bizarre. Like, that's one of my reasons, is it's so heavily needed in my part of it. I mean, although Lewis is a tiny part, it's an island and it's cut off. And there are people there who don't think they don't have any support. People who might be minded like me, who think they're all alone up there. I think Caroline said she experienced it when she was in Sky.
She did.
She said she felt badly isolated there. And I know there's a lot of people up there who do feel kind of isolated from the community.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, it is quite bad. And when we have national and international commentators such as Baroness Warsey, you know, in the Vatican about aggressive militant secularism and the global publicity that gets, you know, I do despair. I do. Because it just makes it's like, you know, we're out to get you. We want to deprive your kids of morality, rights, and religious freedom. And that's just nonsense, utter nonsense. We want to actually defend those very things. We just don't think they should spill out into the public realm. I mean, you should be allowed, absolutely allowed to manifest a religion, but when it comes to influencing education acts, in fact, when the 1980, I'll give you a classic example of how wrong this is. The 1980 Education Act trumps the 2010 Equality Act. And the reason that this happens in Scotland is they've got affirmative discrimination when it comes to Roman Catholics. Now, in Falkirk, the local authority is going to be banning non-Catholic children from attending the local denominational school. And the reason that they're doing that is because under the 1980 Education Act, as part of that legislation, it says they are allowed to positively discriminate against those children. Now, 4 and 5 year old children who perhaps live next door to each other have got absolutely no idea why they're going to be going to different schools. So instantly, we endorse segregation, we endorse sectarianism, we proactively promote it. It's in our legislation. And it's just utterly absurd. There should not be religious education as such. There should only be education in this country. And that's all children should be exposed to. But hey, you know, it's when you have people like, again, David Cameron coming out talking about Christian values, and we have all our politicians telling us that, you know, Christianity, we're a Christian country, and yet 57% of Scots, according to this, Scottish Social Attitude Survey last year said that they don't belong to any religion. In fact, 67% said that they don't go to anything that is remotely religious, and if they go to a church, it's only because their mate happens to get married in there.
There's just one thing I do remember. It was Matt Dillahunty said that people got secularism wrong, that actually, if you're religious, it's something you should want because it protects you as well.
Yeah.
Regardless of your faith, every person of faith should want secularism because it'll protect you in the long run. It's not about favor. That's the only way. It's about not favoring anyone's religion by being neutral on it.
And exactly.
That's
exactly
all it is.
If you take England, I mean, these comments that David Cameron came out with. I mean, if you were a Muslim and you were thinking about the context of Islam, how would you feel that the country you were born in, you were brought up in, you happen to be a Muslim, and you're told that, yeah, but this is a defined country based on Christian values that are completely, they would understand the moral and ethical viewpoint of Christian values if such things exist. But for them to be told that you are different, you're not like us, we're a Christian country, and your faith is different. So we constantly go on about multiculturalism and integration. I mean, what better way to alienate, you know, 3 million people than to tell them that they're incompatible with Christian values. But it's but what grips me the most is that to go back again, is that term militant. I mean, it really, really irks me. It does. But we've got a battle on our hands when it comes to these things, Callan, and unfortunately it's going to remain so.
Okay, I think we're coming up for time here. So, as always, Spencer, I'll let you have a little bit of a soapbox moment. You can, if people have gotten interested hearing this, how they can get involved themselves.
Yeah, please do. We have a fantastically active Facebook group called Secular Scotland. It's moderated by admins who are all members of the Scottish Secular Society, but it's an open platform for discussion. It doesn't always go in the direction we would like it to, but goodness, it's a fantastic active hub. So if you have a point of view on secularism or you have an affiliation to any secular bodies, please come in and join us. And we're also on Twitter, so if you follow Scottish Secular Society or Secular Scotland, you'll find us on Twitter as well. We have almost 1,000 followers. And if you go on our website, the Scottish Secular Society as well, that's all you have to Google and you'll find us, everything that we've been up to there regarding our constitution, our petitions, and what the current situation is for secularism in Scotland and the challenges that we face.
And I suppose I'll just finish this off just to, because it was just discussed last night, so we can confirm it by the time this will go out on the 30th of August or so. So if you're interested in the referendum, Throwing with Logic and Secular Scotland, we're getting together. We'll be doing a special live stream through the night on the night of the results. It'll start at 9 p.m. UK time. It's an hour before the polls close. Spencer, I think you're going to be there for...
Yeah, I'll be there. I'll have a few beers in my hand.
And we're hoping to get people, yes, no's, didn't vote. Regardless of what your opinion is, please join us for this. We'd love to hear from you. And we're hoping to hear from everyone around the country as the results go in. So it's an experiment. We hope it goes well, but it'll be a lot of fun. And that'll be on vonlive.tv/throwingwithlogic. It's not a true Throwing With Logic show. As I said, it's in conjunction with Secular Scotland. It's a joint effort between just to give people basically an alternative to the TV view, because you can only watch men in suits talking dry, so we'll be having beers and probably shouting at each other and all that.
Come with banter with us.
Yeah, so yeah, if you want that version of the results, you'll know where to come. So please do join us for that. And thank you very much, Spencer, for taking the time out.
Oh, thank you, Carl. A pleasure, as always, mate. Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. And I think the next segment in this very first show, we've got Big Lundy with his Guide to Philosophy coming up. So we'll see you all. I'll see you at the end of the show. See you later, people.
Hey there, everybody. Big Lundy here, coming at you with Philosophy Time. This is going to be a semi-regular segment on the Trolling with Logic podcast, wherein I, in my infinite wisdom, do my best not to sound like an idiot while I explain the basics of logic, philosophy, and delve into particular subjects regarding them. Since this is audio only, and I do plan to get a mite bit technical on my explanations, it would be beneficial to take some notes to get the full effect of my segments. Today, we're going to start with a basic introduction to logic. And I know some of you are probably thinking, oh, come on, Lundy, we already know what logic is, and maybe you do. But that doesn't mean that a lot of people who think they do, in reality, have a bit of a misunderstanding as to what logic pertains to. Logic, at its core, is mathematics. A logical syllogism, or a logical statement, can always be reduced to a mathematical equation. Let's take it for instance. Wherein A equals all men, and B equals Socrates, and C equals mortal, and D equals man, we can reduce the statement, Socrates was a man, Socrates was mortal, therefore all men are mortal, into the equation B into D, B into C, D into A, therefore C. Now, while the conclusion of this statement can ostensibly be said to be true, I mean, all men are mortal, the equation itself is logically fallacious. What's a fallacy, though? A fallacy is basically when the math is wrong. It means that one of the statements doesn't necessarily flow into the next. A fallacy is not an incorrect statement. I cannot stress that enough. In fact, to say that the conclusion that one draws from a statement is incorrect because the precursing premises are fallacious is in itself a fallacy. It's known as the fallacist's fallacy. Incorrect methodology does not negate the possible truth of the conclusion. Back to our statement of Socrates. What part of Socrates was a man, Socrates was mortal, therefore all men are mortal, is fallacious? Well, the conflation with Socrates' mortality and all men's mortality. In other words, when we look at our equation, B into C was not logically connected to D into A, and thus A equals C does not follow. So what do we need in order to make a complete logical statement? We need the following four things. Number one, consistency, wherein nothing in the statement contradicts itself. Number two, validity, wherein each part of the statement naturally flows into the next. Number three, completeness, wherein the statement can be reduced to a mathematical equation, thus, therefore, proved. And number four, soundness. The truth of each premise must be established. So let's make our statement free of problems. Socrates is a man. All men are mortal, therefore Socrates was mortal. Or, using the variables that we established prior, B into D, A into C, D into A, B, therefore C. In our new statement, our conclusion is different, but it's also justified. The relationship between D and A is established, and the fact that A into C and D into A as a result of their relationship, and since B into D, B therefore C. So, in this lesson, we've learned the following. A, what logic is, a mathematical system used to analyze the truth of the world around us. B, what a logical statement must consist of, those things being consistency, validity, completeness, and soundness. 3, how to construct a logical statement, by making sure that it's bereft of logical fallacies, which we've already learned what they are, and also making sure that it can be reduced to a mathematical equation by taking all the subjects and reducing them to variables. And of course, what a logical fallacy is and what it is not. That being a thing, a premise that does not lead into the next, or saying something that is not necessarily true in regards to a premise as a result of its fallaciousness. So, as a bit of homework, I recommend looking up the symbolic language required to express a mathematical logical equation. Then, create your own logical statements. Make sure they're complete, consistent, valid, and sound. Try and make it look like your logical statements are connected to each other. Every single premise must flow into either the next or at least some other premise prior to coming to the conclusion. Otherwise, you're not going to have a complete conclusion, and you might have a fallacious conclusion, or rather an invalid one. This is Big Lundy, just giving you your quick tip on philosophy and logic for today. Everyone, have a good one.
Anybody able to use the photosensitive ganglion cells in their retinas, together with all the other highly evolved parts of their optic system enabling them to see, can look up at the night sky and notice that the stars they can see appear to revolve around a central point. In the northern hemisphere, you will notice that the closest star to this central point is Polaris. In the southern hemisphere, you will notice that the closest star is Sigma Octantis. So, to begin with, Polaris is visible when you look towards the north, in the northern hemisphere, and Sigma Octantis is visible when you look towards the south, in the southern hemisphere. Somehow, God only knows how, as you walk away from whatever pole star you can see as you cross the equator, the pole star must jump ahead of you. This is a remarkable celestial feat. The other problem naturally arises when you observe the motions of the two pole stars. Polaris can be seen moving counterclockwise around the night sky, while Sigma Octantis travels clockwise around its central point. This provides a massive problem to the Flat Earth conjecture and a fucking massive clue about the shape of the Earth. Flat Earthers of any denomination cannot account for the fact that anybody living inward from that government conspiracy concocted line called the equator would view Polaris moving in a counterclockwise direction, and yet anybody living outside that same line would not see Polaris, but would see Sigma Octantis moving in the opposite direction. When pressed on this, Flat Earthers draw an amusing blank. The sky must, for Rory's conjecture about Polaris and Sigma Octantis being the same star to be true, magically flip over when one crosses the equator. When that last video was uploaded, I noticed that Rory Cooper had deleted all of his past videos. No matter, I'd already downloaded most of them by then anyway, so there's still plenty to go through. But since the content and claims of his new videos differ little, there's still a lot of relevant stuff to work with. Given this fact, it seems strange that he should have deleted his videos at all. It couldn't possibly be because the man who likes to wail on and on about a conspiracy of censorship wanted to delete all traces of the poundings his moronic musings attracted from more scientifically literate observers, could it? Despite Rory's bizarre tactic, we will continue with this series called The Earth is Flat, Rory Cooper Says So, because his claims haven't changed, and because it will annoy Jennin Kalogia, who believes himself to be the gold standard for information on the Flat Earth. Oh, oh, clear. I'm sorry, I find it impossible to say that phrase whilst keeping a straight face. Yet another conjecture postulated by the Flat Earth community to explain away the horizon is that it is always at eye level. I'll say that again for those of you whose minds shut down at the stupid overload. It is always at eye level. Big problem with this is that eye level literally means at the same altitude as your eyes, and not just along whatever angle your line of sight is looking in, a subtle difference that is entirely lost on the Flat Earth community. Unfortunately, this conjecture couldn't be correct, even if the Earth was flat. Look, since the Earth is flat in this model, and the vector describing the altitude of your eyes must therefore be parallel to the Earth, the horizon cannot be at eye level, because parallel lines don't meet by definition. And on top of all this, when I suggested you could ask Barber why his paper wasn't available for free on his website, but instead only available for you to buy via Springer, you said that I was, quote, making excuses for him, and that, quote, if a creationist were to do this, you would really criticize him for such an evasive tactic. Now hang on, Malcolm. Are you incredulous that I'm not criticizing someone who you believe wrote a geocentrist paper for doing something that you believe I should criticize someone for if they'd written a geocentrist paper? I think you're muddling up your argument, Malcolm. Are you arguing that he is a geocentrist who wrote a geocentrist paper and you want me to criticize him? Or are you saying this isn't a geocentrist paper and you want me to criticize him? Which would make no sense because that would have just completely undermined your entire argument around this paper. Which is it, Malcolm? Seriously, I really don't know what point you're trying to make here. You confused your argument, Malcolm, and now I'm confused. Neither option makes any sense. Do you want me to criticize a geocentrist for being supposedly underhanded, even though this isn't anywhere near being underhanded? Or is this not a geocentrist paper? You've completely undermined yourself with this. I'm actually speechless at this point. Even you don't seem to know what's going on. And it's your argument, Malcolm.
And this is the end of our very first new format show. How did you enjoy it, guys?
I don't know. I haven't listened to it yet.
That's a great thing, Gene, pre-recorded.
What an amazing show. Wow. Did you see that part with the guy? Wow.
The guy that said the thing and did the stuff with the other thing. Oh, but seriously, this is just to let you know, as you probably see in the description on the podcast feed and on the YouTube video, we have launched a Patreon if you do want to support us. Like I said earlier, we don't intend to make a living out of this. We don't want to personally make any money of it. What we are after is just a modest sum, $75 for each episode, which I don't know if you guys do. I think that's fairly reasonable and achievable for us. A little breakdown, just basically, what you're going to be helping us do is, number one, we use a voice client called Mumble because we want to get away from Skype because Skype is just so unreliable. And like I said, the quality on Mumble is better. It allows multi-track recording, which means our editor's job becomes 100 times easier, and he could make this show sound amazing because of that. Next thing is we want to move over to a professional file hosting service for our podcast files. Right now, we use the Archive. The Archive is a great free service, but because it's free, it shows it's very slow. And also, when you upload your files, you have very little control. You can't really edit them afterwards. So that'll be the next thing. It'll probably be a Libsyn we'll be getting. And the third thing is, and this is where the big chunk of the money will be going to, it'll be going to our editor. And he'll be essentially taking over the entire editing process. He'll mix it, he'll put in the music, sound effects, whatever. And he'll also take care of uploading it and making sure the shows are always delivered on time. Because, like I said, for me, like, I've been doing it in the past, and sometimes real life takes over and it's not on schedule, and we want the show to be going out regular on schedule, and we want the highest quality possible show for everyone.
And when we say it's going to be mixed with sound effects, we're not talking about a dubstep Michael Bay film. It's going to be done properly.
Yes, it is. And like I said, I don't think, is there anything you guys want to add to that? You want to say anything about the new format?
No, not really.
If anyone would like to send me some whiskey as part of their Patreon, that's perfectly okay.
Oh, speaking of the Patreon, I shall very, very quickly go through the actual rewards you will get. And I think everyone's agreed there's some quite nice little rewards in here for you. Now, say a pledge of $1, and remember it's per episode, and the reason we're asking per episode and not per month is we don't want to be charging people for when there's no content coming out, and I think that's only fair that.
Yeah.
So just a simple $1 and you'll get a subscription to our newsletter, which will let you know what interviews are coming up, and there'll be stuff written by the team there. Nice little bonus there for you. If you pledge $5, you'll not only get to that, but as you've probably heard, the interviews are 20 minutes long, but the recording sessions will be a lot longer. So you'll get access to an exclusive stream where you can hear the interviews in full, completely uncut. And if you get $10, then you get, and I think Pumpkin and Kitch, even they're quite interested in this, the special Throwing with Logic pint glass.
I'm intrigued.
But yeah, basically it has the logo on it, and we'll inscribe it with whatever message you want on it. And then $25, and there's only two of these sets going, and you'll get the pint glass, a set of shot glasses as well, and a Throwing with Logic t-shirt. And again, all of them with whatever message you want on it. And Pumpkin.
These sounds like fantastic, fantastic gifts.
Yeah, you can tell there's a lot of Scottish and Irish on this show somehow, can't you?
Yeah.
I'm drooling a little bit.
Yes. And for $50, this is the main, there's only one of these. You get everything listed above, plus you'll get a nice bottle of 18-year-old Glenfiddich whiskey, and that will also be personalised with whatever inscription, and also a big thank you for the team for being so generous in supporting our project.
And whoever buys that and doesn't give me the whiskey, well, we're going to have problems.
Yes, but I say thank you very much for listening. I say this is the pilot episode. We hope to iron out some of the creases, but please send us your feedback. If you loved it, if you hated it, what we can do better, anything, just come, please, please, we need feedback to make this show as the best possible we can for you. And it's contact@throwingwithlogic.com. Like I said, and if you want to be featured in the unnamed soapbox segment, there you go, you listeners, you can come up with a name for that.
And Bastard on a Box.
Yeah, just upload the audio of your section. Send me a link for the download and we'll have a look at it and consider it for inclusion in the show. Do you guys just want to add anything there before we close out?
Thanks for watching, and to the people in the chat, don't be dicks.
Listening anyway.
Yeah, listening.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. All right, and we shall see you all in the middle of September when we hope to have the full, nice, polished, proper show for you. So thank you very much for tuning in and take care, and we'll see everyone very, very soon. Bye.
Guys, take care, guys. Talk to you later.